All right, thanks very much. I appreciate you coming back from the series of breaks we had, so I'll promise I'll try not to waste your time and finish in time for lunch. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today is aphid natural enemy dynamics under future atmospheric conditions. So a lot of this has been done at the Aspen Face site in northern Wisconsin. Okay, so I'm not about to go through the whole primer of climate change, because I'm sure you've heard way more about this than you ever want to, but in case you've been hiding under a rock for the past 10 or 20 years, you know that the climate is changing. So mostly due to, you know, natural and anthropogenic influences. We are pumping stuff into the air, that is greenhouse gases that are contributing to global warming and changing the atmosphere more than we know. So the two that I'm going to talk about today is carbon dioxide and tropospheric ozone. So if we look at CO2 concentration on the y-axis and year on the x-axis, you can see these very nice patterns how around the Industrial Revolution time, CO2 concentrations really started to increase. They keep going up, and then once Keeling started doing his recordings at Mauna Loa in Hawaii in 1958, in fact, just this year is the 50th anniversary of the Keeling curve from those CO2 measurements, you can see that it's increasing even more, and in fact, this doesn't even go up to 2000, it's a lot higher than this now. So CO2 levels have been predicted to be about 530 parts per million by the year 2050, and probably about 700 parts per million by the year 2100. So every time you drive your car and you burn a gallon of gasoline, you're putting approximately 20 pounds of CO2 into the air. The good news is the U.S. is now not the number one producer of CO2. In fact, it's now China. So, yay, we're number two. All right. One you tend not to hear a lot about anymore is tropospheric ozone. And in fact, I think a lot of this has to do with the confusion of stratospheric versus tropospheric ozone. That is, people are always concerned about the ozone layer, and you know, we need more ozone because we have to have this layer. Well, that's absolutely true, but you don't want to hear have ozone right next to where we are. So if you see ozone concentration on the y-axis and year on the x-axis, it is increasing in a steady fashion as well. So it's a little harder to get accurate recordings of what those ozone levels are because it's more regional, but here's some data from Germany that shows it's increasing a little over 1.5% a year. And they have predicted that by 2100, probably about 60% of global forests will probably be exposed to damaging levels of ozone. Okay, so why is this all important to you? Well, I'm sure a lot of people sitting in this room right now have something to do either with plants, insects, or natural enemies that feed on those insects. So why should you be interested in this? Because a lot of this is probably going to change in the next 50 to 100 years. One of the things that I tend to look at are trophic dynamics, and that is, what's the effect on the host plants? What's the effect on the herbivores? And as you heard in the seminars this morning, natural enemies. And we know virtually nothing about what's going to happen to natural enemies under conditions of atmospheric change. As you can also see, these arrows really go in both directions. So we can't view it as these simple chains that natural enemies feed on herbivores, herbivores feed on the host plants. Host plants often change in response to the herbivores. We know that. Herbivores often change in response to the natural enemies. So really, these are cyclical things that we're looking at. So really, what we have to start asking ourselves is, will herbivore natural enemy dynamics change in future environments? And if they do, can we actually get past patterns and start looking at mechanisms? And some of the talks we've heard about today have really gone in that direction, and that's exactly where we need to go. Okay, so I tend to use aphids as my study systems. Why do I use aphids? Because they're small. And if they're small, that's a good thing because they don't travel very far. They're also very easy to rear. They have very short generation time. So if you want to know how atmospheric change is going to affect an insect, choose one that has generations of about 10 days. That's a very good thing. You don't have to wait 50 or 100 years to know the effects. Okay. So I'm also a borderline chemical ecologist, if you want to think of it that way. And one of the things that's become really apparent in my research is that pheromones are incredibly important for aphids and aphid life history patterns. They use pheromones in different ways. Some are short-term responses, so aphids do have alarm pheromones. And they also have long-term effects that you will also see from pheromones. So these long-term effects have to do basically with eavesdropping on natural enemy pheromones. And let me explain these a little better. So alarm pheromones, when an aphid is actually attacked by a predator or parasitoid, it will raise up these cornicles, these paired tubular appendages, and emit this droplet of fluid. And that is known to have an alarm substance in it that causes other nearby conspecifics to disperse away from the area. So that's one of the things I'm interested in, is alarm signaling activity and how does that dispersal response change in response to pheromone. And also natural enemy pheromones. So it's clear from the research I've done so far and the research that other labs have done, is that natural enemies, if you want to think of them, such as ladybugs, they will often leave pheromone trails while they're foraging for aphids. We do know that aphids can actually respond to those pheromone trails, and they will change the offspring phenotypes of their clutches. So for example, pea aphids, when they are exposed to natural enemy trails, they will change the proportion of winged versus unwinged offspring in their clutches. So why is this important to know something about pheromones and these short-term and long-term responses? Well, basically, herbivore dispersal is directly tied to outbreak duration. So the more dispersal you're going to have, we already know from the basis of studies that have been done, aphids will move from patch to patch and plant to plant. As they start moving from plant to plant and patch to patch, that significantly increases the length of the outbreaks of those pest populations. Okay, so in order to know if any of these effects are going to change in response to atmospheric change, you have to have a place that you can actually do experiments like this. And one of the places that I do it is at the Aspirin Free Air CO2 Enrichment Project that's up in Harshaw, Wisconsin. So this whole site's about 32 acres. There's 12 rings, as you can see here. Each one of these is a ring where they have increased levels of either CO2 or ozone diffusing onto these trees all summer long. Here's a close-up of one of those rings you see in those pictures. So they're about 100 feet across. So you heard about the soy face project this morning. Our rings are bigger, though. We have the biggest rings, so that's good. And you see these vertical vent pipes, and there's different concentrations of gases. It's all computer-controlled, diffusing onto these trees all summer long. It's set up in a full factorial design, so basically you have three rings that are ambient ozone, ambient CO2, three that are elevated ozone, three that are elevated CO2, and three that are both elevated ozone and elevated CO2. Okay, so here's the dirty little secret, as you probably heard again this morning. What's going to happen to trees when they're exposed to elevated CO2? They actually look better. They grow bigger, they're nice and green, they're nice and lush, because most of the plants that we actually think of today when you walk outside are CO2 limited. So if we give them more CO2, they can directly incorporate that as photosynthesis. Okay, so let's take a look at this same ring shot, basically from an ozone ring on the next slide, and see what the effect of tropospheric ozone is. That's the effect of tropospheric ozone. The trees a lot of times are stunted, they're weak, some genotypes have completely been taken out, they've died. The nice part is you do get this nice ground cover, mostly in weedy species, that tend to occur when those trees have disappeared. Okay, so in order to study alarm pheromones, one of the species that I work on is Chytophorus defensis. It's a great aphid because, as you can see, that thing is so tiny, it's difficult for it to go anywhere. There's the size of my thumb, and that's how big that aphid is. They spend their entire life history patterns inside those rings on those trees. So if you want to know the effects of atmospheric change on alarm signals, you have to choose something that's going to spend its entire life in those rings and not disperse from one to the other. So in a very, very simplified fashion here, let's just say you took an individual aphid, choose it at random, and simply have it either emit a cornicle droplet, and you can simply probe them on the back, get them to induce a cornicle droplet. Either have them do it or not have them do it. And simply look at the level of alarm activity that goes on in that colony when you do that. Very simple. Okay, so if you have proportion of aphids dispersing on the y-axis, and you have aphid instar on the x-axis, and you can actually gauge aphid instar on the basis of size, roughly, of the aphid, The good news is they do respond to alarm pheromone. So if you just test the ones that have a cortical droplet and those that don't, they actually will disperse if they get a cortical droplet. Okay, so increased CO2, if we look at the increased CO2 treatments, it actually decreases the alarm responses. So in yellow here is the ambient CO2 for the different INSTARs, and green is the increased CO2. For every case, each of those age groups, if they are on a leaf in a ring that has increased CO2, you get significantly decreased alarm responses in response to those cortical droplets. If you take a look at the ozone rings, you get the completely opposite response. So that is, aphids that have grown up on leaves in those ozone rings have significantly higher alarm reactions than do aphids grown under the ambient conditions. So aphids actually do alter their escape behavior under these altered atmospheric conditions. So if CO2 goes up, alarm responses go down. If ozone goes up, alarm responses also go up. What's the reason for this? Hard to say. The most parsimonious answer would be, well, if they're on a good CO2 leaf, they might not disperse because it's a trade-off between food and predation risk. Other evidence we have from one of my co-authors, Caroline Omack, would suggest it's not that simple. So it's going to take more investigating yet to figure out what the actual effects really underlying this are. Okay, so eavesdropping on natural enemy pheromones. You saw that really nice understory that was growing in those face rings. A lot of that is solidago. So goldenrod, solidago canadensis is very common in the understory of those rings. And it tends to get a really nice big red aphid on there, a Euroleucon, that if you're not familiar with aphids, these literally are the horses of the aphid world. They're about 4 millimeters long. You know, that's giant in aphid land. So they're very easy to work with, they're very easy to manipulate, and you can do really nice experiments on goldenrod with them. Okay, so what I did is I put an individual Apteris adult on a clean goldenrod plant after it had been searched by one of the following things. So for some plants, I didn't put any natural enemies on there at all. Others, I put a Hymenopteran parasitoid on, and we know this one, we have reared it from Euroleucons, we know it does regularly attack it in the field. And then in others, I put a coccinella predator on, let it search for about 72 hours inside a mesh bag, so you know it's searching on that plant. After that 72 hours, take that natural enemy out, put the aphid on, put the bag back on, let it have some offspring, take the adult out, let those offspring develop. What offspring phenotypes are actually produced in response to that increased predation risk? Well, we do know if we lump all the data together that the aphids actually do detect enemies. So just like those pea aphids that I showed you before, if that plant had previously been searched by either a predator or a parasitoid, they do significantly increase the proportion of winged offspring that they produce. But it gets a little scary when you start looking at CO2 or ozone because you start getting these interacting effects going on. So for example, proportion of winged morphs, if we take a look at wings, they actually produce more winged offspring in response to predators under increased CO2. But there doesn't look to be any differential effect if there was parasitoids under increased CO2. Then we get a flip-flop in response to ozone. So now there doesn't seem to be any difference in response to the predators under increased ozone, but there is a big difference in response to the parasitoids under increased ozone. So aphids actually do alter this wing induction response in response to altered atmospheric conditions as well. So if there's increased CO2, they'll produce more winged offspring in response to predators. If it's increased ozone, they'll produce more winged offspring in response to parasitoids. So just like you've heard in all the talks this morning, these effects are really complicated, and it's going to take a lot of time to actually figure out what is underlying these effects. So will herbivore natural enemy dynamics change in future environments? Absolutely. There's no question these are going to change. Is that good news for us? Well, it's good news and bad news. The bad news is climate change is occurring and it's still going on. The good news is we'll all have jobs because it's going to take a lot of us to figure out what's actually happening. So what are the mechanisms? We haven't even started scratching the surface on what these mechanisms are. We do know the host plants differ in quality and quantity. We do know the herbivores can respond to that, but there's also direct and indirect effects of these natural enemies on these herbivore populations, and the herbivores can respond to that equally well. So what we really need to do is to try to keep understanding these population responses, because that's the only way we're really going to be able to predict these community changes in future environments. Okay, and I'd just like to acknowledge a few people. Dave Karnosky, who really was the pioneer of the FACE site, who very suddenly passed away only about 2 weeks ago. He was the driving force of the Aspen FACE, and he will be sorely missed. Collaborators that have helped me on this research, Michelle Tremblay, Rick Lindroth at Madison, Caroline Amack, the Aspen FACE site operator, Jock Sober, who we call Lord of the Rings to keep all that going, NSF for funding, and all the other sources of funding that have helped contribute that to that work. Thank you very much.
Questions for Ed?
Any questions?
Yes.
What do you expect to be the mechanism for the different responses to predators and parasites?
That's a very good question. The question is, what might underlie the differential responses to the predators and parasites? We have thought anywhere from differential search behaviors, maybe they search differently. There's actually one paper that's been published that I know of showing that different pheromones might break down differently under conditions of increased ozone. So if they are laying down search tracks that are pheromones and those do break down differentially in response to ozone, that might underlie some of it too. That's a million-dollar question, absolutely right. Sorry? Ants. Did we consider ants? No, we have never done anything with ants. But we do know there was not ants foraging in the bags, because we check those on a very regular basis. Yes?
Are you doing anything to quantify the difference in plant architecture under the two treatments? Because it seems that that's really radically different, and that would also be impacting search behavior.
Absolutely. So that's a very good point. In fact, we tried to pick plants that were virtually identical. How are they identical? Hard to say. But at least visually, the architecture was very similar. So for example, goldenrod always has the single shoot. None of them were flowering when we actually did it. You know, are they all the same? Hard to say. They were chosen randomly. So I'm hoping we got away from that. But very good point. Yes. That's interesting. I didn't know that. That's absolutely fascinating. So there might be microbes that actually break down the pheromones under those different atmospheric conditions. That's neat. Cool. Other labs have. We have not. So it does consist of things like tricosane and pentacosane. We're actually working on trying to identify, you know, using their data, if we can use the actual compounds to see if we can induce it. We're working.
Usual needles. And would you consider the aphid a social predator?
No. Right. And that, in the aphid world, that's a whole ball of wax if you want to talk about social aphids. Because, in fact, there are certain species that do live in galls, and they have soldiers and stem mothers. The ones that I work on definitely are not social. There is some level of kin selection, definitely for alarm pheromone evolution. But I would not consider them social. Good point, though.
That's unusual because they're warning each other.
Absolutely. And, in fact, that's found now in over 25 genera of aphids. So almost all aphids have a learn pheromone.
So for waterborne summers, do you have also some companion data on just population dynamics data for the aphids/parasitoid systems that you could understand?
Yes, and I will say, Caroline Amack, that is one of the co-authors on here, she actually has some data sets like that with the actual aphids and the parasites, not bagged, just natural in the range to see how they do fluctuate. And they actually do. So we're in the process. We're going to try to tie those together and see how they can actually help explain each other. Yes, so Mike Hillstrom is giving a talk at 4:30 today that's going to start talking about community level effects at Aspen Face. So I do encourage you to go and hear that talk.
Any other questions? All right. Thanks again. I just wanted to thank all the speakers once again and all the audience members that came, and let's give everyone else another round of applause for the presentations.